Hi, everybody. This is the Ramble Redhead Show, and we'd like to welcome you today. Today, I have a brand new guest to the show, and his name is Rick Merritt, and he is an author. And he's written a book called Secrets of a Gay Marine Porn Star. And sounds like a very exciting book. And what I'd like to do is have you welcome Rich to the show. Hey, Rich, how are you doing today?
Hey, Tom. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very good. And, well, first of all, I'd like to thank you very much for being part of the program.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, no problem. And, well, what I'd like to do is if you could just tell my fabulous listeners a little bit about you right now, like where you are and how old you are. You're currently living in New York, right?
Right. I moved to New York City in January. I'm 38 years old.
Okay.
And I'm still working as an attorney. That's my day job. And I'm working on a second book as I can and other projects. So, yeah, staying really busy.
Okay, good. And I was just curious, where were you born?
Greenville, South Carolina.
Okay. And did you live there pretty much most of your childhood then?
I lived in a nearby community called Piedmont, which is a tiny town of about 1,500 people. And to us, Greenville was the metropolis, and it was about 15 miles away. And I lived there until I was 23. And so, yeah, I grew up between, you know, those communities, Piedmont and Greenville. That was my childhood home.
Okay, great. And I understand that you went to the Bob Jones Elementary School and as well as the university as for college. Is that correct?
Right. I started Bob Jones Elementary School in the first grade, and that was 1973. I went all the way up through Bob Jones Junior High School and Bob Jones Academy and did 2 years of college before I was asked to go elsewhere to finish my college.
Okay. And for those who may not be familiar with that, can you tell us a little bit more about that school or those schools?
Well, sure. Bob Jones University has been in the news a lot over the years.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, they did not allow African-American students. And well, for a long time, they didn't allow African-American students at all. And then in the early 70s, they didn't discriminate on that basis anymore, but they continued to have a rule on the campus for the students that African-American students and white students could not date one another. And so that stayed on for a long time.
Wow.
Of course, you know, gays and lesbians were just not allowed at all, but you can hide that a lot more than you can hide your skin color.
Exactly.
Then I think in the year 2000, George Bush visited Bob Jones because he had the South Carolina primary coming up, and he had just lost New Hampshire to John McCain,
mm-hmm.
and so he desperately needed to win in South Carolina. And Bob Jones is in Greenville, South Carolina. It's a university of about 5,000 students. Of course, they have the elementary school and all that. They call themselves the Fortress of Fundamentalism. They used to anyway. I haven't seen that so much anymore in their literature, but when I was there, it was called the Fortress of Fundamentalism. And in 2000, George Bush gave a speech there where a lot of people criticized him because Bob Jones is not only perceived to be racist, they're also very anti-Catholic. And that George Bush actually felt compelled to write a letter to Cardinal O'Connor explaining why he had gone there. So pretty big deal. And then right after that, on Larry King one night, I was in California, and I was happened to be watching it. Dr. Bob Jones III, then president of the university, came on Larry King's show and changed the policy right there and said, from now on, African-American students can date white students. And that was the year 2000. So it's like, welcome to the 60s, you know?
Wow. Amazing. So what was that like going to that school during that time? And obviously you are a gay person, so let me ask you this quick before you get to answer that. How old were you when you realized that you actually had gay feelings then?
Before I finally admitted to myself that that's what it was, I was 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I had been out of Bob Jones for a long time, for 5 years at that point.
Did you?
I wasn't even dealing with it when I was at Bob Jones. It was just something that was way down beneath the levels of consciousness that I was ready to admit.
So even as a teenager, you didn't have any feelings or inklings like that?
Well, having feelings is one thing. Calling those feelings what they are is a completely separate
okay,
matter.
So,
I totally mislabeled. You know, I had these strong feelings for my best friend,
mm-hmm.
and I just assumed they had the same feelings for me, but, you know, we couldn't be gay because we were taught that being gay is evil, and that gays are evil people. And,
right.
But, well, I can't be that, so what I am must be normal.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I would push the envelope of that, but, you know, fortunately I never got in any trouble, never got beat up or anything. Although maybe if I had, it would have come out sooner, who knows?
Yeah.
But I think in the book and in other places I've called it mental gymnastics, which the hoops you have to jump through to convince yourself that you're straight.
Right.
And I did it very well.
And I'm sorry, say that last line again?
Oh, I did that very well.
Oh, you did that very well. Okay, I wanted to make sure I heard you right. Okay, so obviously you had feelings then as a teenager and then going into college, but you just didn't act on it, is that correct?
I didn't act on it until after college.
Okay.
And that's a pretty interesting scene in the book. I can't remember which chapter it is, 6 or 7.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a sexual experience with a guy. The first time I ever had sex at all, I was 23.
Okay.
And it was with a guy, and it was with a guy who was straight, supposedly, and still is, I guess. And we were both very drunk, and it was at it was after a party, and I just convinced myself that, well, I was drunk. That's not what I would normally have done had I not been drunk. So that's how I rationalized it there. But then about 9 months later, I was on active duty. I was at an army base in El Paso, Texas, called Fort Bliss. And an army guy hit on me at the gym, and I went home with him.
Wow.
So, yeah, and then I went back twice, but yet I'm still straight. So, but I was starting to suspect that maybe I'm not straight.
Right.
So when I went overseas to Japan and Korea and the Philippines, tried to convince myself that I was straight, and by the end of the year over there, it didn't really work. I finally met another Marine who was gay, who people suspected was gay, but I found out for sure. And at that point, that's when I realized this has happened 3 times now, so I guess that establishes a trend.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came back to California, I left Okinawa and went back to Camp Pendleton in San Diego. And that's when I decided, okay, I'm out of the closet now as much as I can be, and I'm going to be gay. So that was when I was 25.
Okay, so, well, let's just backtrack one bit here. So you, while you were going to Bob Jones University, you also then enlisted into the Marines. What year was that?
Yeah, there was some overlap there because what happened was as soon as I turned 18, I was a freshman in college. And I went ahead and joined the Marine Reserves. So I went to college a semester, but then I stayed out a semester and went to the same Marine Corps boot camp that every Marine goes to,
mm-hmm.
active reserve. And then I went to a follow-on school for my specialty, and that was in Alabama. And then I came back to Bob Jones, came back to Greenville, and joined a reserve unit there. So while I was continuing my college education, I was simultaneously drilling with a reserve unit. And then I was also, in the summers, I was going to officer candidate school because I knew I wanted to be an officer. So I kind of had a lot going on there.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Okay, so what was your desire? Why did you decide you wanted to go into the Marines?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I've forgotten most of the reasons. I thought when I was writing the book, I would think of a reason and I would jot it down. And so it's pretty good. Covered that pretty well, I think, in the book. But in the end, it's just if you have to explain to someone why wanted to be a Marine, they're never going to understand the answer. The flip side of that is people who get it really get it.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a cop-out, but there's just something about being a Marine, that mystique that goes with it. You know, you can call it mystique or you can call it very well-crafted propaganda, depending on how you look at it.
Okay.
I call it mystique, and I really like that. I like being a Marine. I like the idea of it, and you know, the truth is, when I was in the Marines, every night when I went to bed, I felt good about what I had done that day for my country and for, you know, myself. And honestly, since I got out, it hasn't been the same. I miss that. But I also like the idea, I think, on a subconscious level, being around a lot of men. I also wanted to be thought, well, I was, you know, like a lot of gay men and straight men, I guess, who aren't hyper-masculine. I was called a sissy, a fairy, and all that when I was in high school, and I thought, wow, if I'm a Marine, no one could ever call me that again.
Right.
That was a big part of it.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's really because I've talked to I talked to a lot of people that had served in the military and basically covered every military branch, and each one has their own individual reason why they wanted to go, and even though they knew they had, you know, gay feelings, that they wanted to, you know, still do this. They wanted to do it not only for the country, they wanted to do it for themselves. They wanted to do it for their family. Like one gentleman, he wanted to follow the family tradition, and so it was that was a big motivator for him. And you know, and then I talked with you know, Heather, she's a lesbian who went into the Air Force, and her major motivation was to continue like in her parents' footsteps and to get the education and, you know, and get all the things that you can get from that. And so again, I'd just like to remind people that if you're a new listener to the program, that I did several interviews with many members of the Call to Duty Tour, which traveled all over the country this year, as well as going to be doing a future one, talking about the gay and the don't ask, don't tell policy and things like that. So it's very, very interesting stuff. So if you are a new listener, please go back and listen. But I was just wondering, once you went through boot camp and once you went through, you know, obviously your training, and then you continued to, you know, go to school then, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I still had about, when I got out of boot camp, I still had 3.5 years of college left. Okay. I continued on with that.
So you were strictly the reserves, though, right?
At that point, I was strictly reserves. Now, mm-hmm. I was going to officer candidate school at Quantico, Virginia. I did that for 2 summers.
Okay.
And that was for when I graduated from college, becoming an officer. Mm-hmm. On active duty, all officers in the Marines have to have at least a bachelor's degree.
Right.
Before they can be commissioned as a second lieutenant. And so that was my goal there. So I was doing, I had the enlisted thing going in the reserves, and I made it up to the rank of sergeant that way. But mm-hmm. then the minute I graduated from college, boom, I became a second lieutenant.
Okay, cool.
And it was kind of a lot of conflict there because that was the same time the first Gulf War was happening. And the August, I graduated in December, and in that August before of 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. So suddenly I have 1 semester left, and the drill unit is being activated to go to Iraq. Yeah. And they're telling me, well, we don't care if you're close to graduation, you're part of a reserve unit, you're getting activated. And I was kind of torn because I didn't want to leave my, you know, watch all my buddies go over there that I've been drilling with for 4 years at this point. But also, I've been working very hard to become an officer. So I convinced the captain to let me stay and graduate.
Oh, so you did. Okay.
Yeah.
So did you go back afterwards, or did you go to wherever you had to go once you became an officer?
Well, at that point, I went to Quantico, Virginia full-time for training.
Mm-hmm.
As an officer, that's a 6-month program. By the time we were done, the first Gulf War was already over.
Right.
Unlike this war, which is dragging on forever, that mm-hmm. one lasted, I think, like 3 months or something.
Right.
Less than that even.
Okay. Well, I'm reading online. I know, again, we're doing a little bit of overlap, but one of the things I was really curious about that you wrote on your website, which for the listeners, if they'd like to check it out after the show, it's www.richmerritt.com. RichMerritt.com, and you can find out more information. One of the things that I'm reading right now, it says that within 2 semesters that you were expelled from the Bob Jones University, and I was just wondering, can I ask what happened at that point?
Oh, yeah, that's a good story. You know, for me, a lot of people ask, how did I go from being this model Christian student at Bob Jones Academy? I was president of my senior class. I was you know, all this geeky stuff like band and drama, of course, drama club, to being, you know, who I am now and what happened. Well, when I went to boot camp, you have to understand, that was the first time I had ever been away from fundamentalism. My rack mate at boot camp was Catholic. It was the first time I had ever had a conversation with someone who was openly Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was just such an eye-opening experience, because as after 3 months went by of being in the same boot camp hell with these same guys, I thought, you know, they all cannot be going to hell when they die. And that's what I was taught as a fundamentalist. Fundamentalists believe that if you don't think exactly like they do, you go to hell when you die. And I just could not reconcile how that could happen. So when I came back to Bob Jones, I was a different person. I had a different perspective looking at things. And I started to question. And that, you can't do that in fundamentalism. Once you begin to question, you're gone. Even though I planned, I said, you know, I'm going to leave this school, go to transfer to Clemson University. The problem is, before I could do that, in my mind I already had, and so I started breaking the rules of Bob Jones. Started going out to nightclubs, straight nightclubs at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I would meet up with the people I worked with, and we would go out dancing. And this one night I wasn't even drinking. I was just dancing with this woman who I worked with. She went back to work and was, you know, talking about what a good time we had. Well, it so happened one of the people we worked with was Stephen Jones, who is now the president of Bob Jones. He's actually about 36 years old. But Stephen's younger than I am, and he went home and told his dad, who was then president, and his dad said he'd take care of it. And next thing you know, I'm called in before one of the disciplinarians there. He said, well, we're not going to give you a chance just to sit there and lie to us, you know, about what we know you've done. We're just concerned about your spirituality. And at this point, I realized, you know, this is not the place that I want to be. And so I said I wanted to withdraw. And they said, well, you can't just withdraw, because we know you've done these things equal the demerit total that would get you expelled. So basically, I was constructively expelled at this point.
Wow.
And I transferred to Clemson, and you know, 2.5 years later, got my degree. It's one of the, at the time, Bob Jones was not accredited. I don't know if they are still. The reason they're not accredited is because they don't want state interference at all in the program. They want to be able to fire a faculty member that steps out of line. They don't give tenure. So you can't do that if you're accredited. They have a very good program for, like, I was an accounting major, some of the best accounting schools South Carolina, so Clemson took the credits, and I was able to transfer. I was one of the lucky ones back then, because not a whole lot of schools were taking credits.
Wow.
Bob Jones.
Wow, well, that's good. I'm glad it worked out for you. So you then got your degree, and then you became an officer, and then, again, I'm reading that you decided to come out when you were at the age of 25, and I was just wondering, who was your first person that you came out to?
Myself. I looked in the mirror. I was shaving one morning, and I was getting ready to come back to the States, and I thought, what am I going to do? Am I going to, you know, I had met this other Marine officer, and I just looked at myself in the mirror, and I said, you know what, I'm gay. And at that point, it was a decision that I had to make. You know, I could go back to the States and find a wife and get married and have kids. You know, get my grandparents' grandkids, which is what they wanted, and just, you know, kind of sneak off and keep what I wanted to do a secret. Well, I could live as openly as I could live in the Marines. And there was, I mean, that was a definite decision point. You know, the Robert Frost poem, the fork in the road, and I took the path less traveled. That's one of those moments in my life that I can vividly recall. So, yeah, it was myself as the first person I admitted it to.
Okay, who is the second person?
Trying to remember, because what I did then was, when I transferred to San Diego, for me it was like I was suddenly in a Camp Pendleton in a new place where I didn't know anyone at the time.
Right.
And so I started going to some of the gay bars in San Diego, and right away I started meeting other Marines. I mean, the first night I go out, you know, there's the telltale haircut.
Uh-huh.
I started meeting other Marines, and So
what was that like? What was that like? Did that scare you at all? Or?
At first it did. At first I was afraid to go out in San Diego because there's just too many bases there. And, you know, we heard the rumors that the Naval Investigative Service would be out patrolling the bars. They would go in the bars and look for, you know, Marines and sailors. And that stuff did happen a lot. This was pre-don't ask, don't tell. And in fact, when the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, this was the same time that Clinton was elected, so it was all really being talked about a lot in the news. And one night, I think the TV news show, 48 Hours, showed up outside the bar where a bunch of us were inside.
Oh, wow.
They actually panned down the sidewalk. Look, here's a military sticker, and here's a military sticker on a car, you know, on all the vehicles parked outside the gay bar. Which was kind of stuff like that was happening. It's kind of scary.
Wow.
And then when Bill Clinton first took office, there were a few people who came out right away.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a mistake for their military career because the law was still the same.
Exactly.
They were discharged under the old law.
Did you know anybody that got caught or that was, you know, found out at all?
Yeah, you know, most of the guys I knew and women who were discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, well, you know, they told, they volunteered, they went to their commanding officer and said, look, I'm tired of living this lie, I'm gay.
Mm-hmm.
Or they just wanted out. They looked at that as a way to get out of the military.
Wow.
By the time I was in, I knew very few people who had actually, you know, were the result of a witch hunt, is what they call it. I mean, that was still going on in some places, but I didn't really know anyone like that. But I did know people who were discharged for it.
Okay. All right. So, were you dating anybody at the time while you were active duty?
Yeah, that's a part of the story. If you want to get into the extracurricular activities I was in at that time, that kind of goes hand in hand with that.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
One of the things that happened at this time was, you know, I left Okinawa, came to California, 25-year-old, newly out gay man. Bill Clinton's the president. I'm thinking, this is absolutely perfect. He's going to lift the ban. I'm going to be able to come completely out, and live an honest, open life. And then I get to California, start making friends, actually for the first time in my life, feeling like a real part of a real community of friends. And then Clinton right immediately runs into these hurdles in Congress and with the military. And by the end of that year, this fiasco known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell had been passed. One of the stupidest compromises in history. And that would be the reason I say that is because it was suddenly written into law. It was a federal law that gays and lesbians could not serve in the United States military just because of who we were.
Right.
And the way it was written, it says homosexuality is incompatible with military service. And that was ridiculous because it's kind of funny. I talk about this in my book, but you know, when I left Okinawa, I wasn't in good shape. But I got to California and quickly saw, if you want to, you know, if you want to be guys, you got to look as good as you possibly can, especially in Southern California.
Right.
So I did the vein thing. I started running a lot on base, you know, 6 miles at lunch every day and working out. By the end of the year, you know, I was getting the best marks I'd ever gotten in the Marine Corps because the Marines evaluate you so much on your physical ability and your personal appearance and how good you look in your uniform.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, to say that homosexuality is incompatible with military service not only is discriminatory, it's blatantly wrong.
Right.
I mean, it's incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, it was very compatible. But that caused a lot of anger. I felt really almost a violent rage at the time because I wasn't dealing with it. And we couldn't deal with it. I mean, what am I supposed to do? Write my congressman? I didn't have an outlet for my anger.
Right.
And a lot of, in San Diego, there's an entire industry built up around getting sailors and Marines into gay porn.
Right.
And if I said that I, you know, was lured into it, I would be lying because, at this time I was, what happened was I was just flipping through one of the rags, the Gay and Lesbian Times. I shouldn't call it a rag. It's actually a good paper. And I saw this ad for male models. And at this point, I thought, well, you know, why not? I'm in the Marines. They don't want me in here because I'm gay. I need to save money. I want to get out and go to law school anyway. And why don't I just see if I'm good looking enough? I won't do it, you know, I won't necessarily do it, but I just want to know if I would make the audition. So I called and went to San Diego to this guy's condominium and auditioned for porno. The next thing I know, I was in one, and then I was in another, and then I was sent to a higher budget film on location up in the Russian River and started meeting more people, you know, the other guys would tell you about other producers, and within a period of 4 months, I had done 8 videos.
Well, back up. What did they make you do to audition? Did you actually...
That was just, basically, he would... The guy's name is Dirk Yates.
Oh, I've heard of that, yeah.
Yeah, he's president of all, or head of All World's Video. He has a condo in San Diego, and so you visited him, and he said, okay, go into the bedroom here, take your clothes off. You want to watch straight porn or gay porn? And I just kind of looked at him, and I thought, I want, you know, gay porn. This is gay porn, right? But I didn't realize then, you know, half the guys that do this are straight.
Right.
So, anyway, put in some gay porn, and he gives you some lube and says, you know, go ahead and start jerking off. And so, you know, I did. It's kind of like he's not even there. He kind of stands off in the corner, and he's got the camera there going, videotaping you. And he says that you have to do this because he's got to send this tape off, like there's some committee or something that's got to approve you.
Right.
But he doesn't tell you. He pays you $20 for this. But he doesn't tell you that he puts all these videos together, and he's got this collection of tapes called The Few, The Proud. And I don't mind giving him this free advertising here, you know, whatever.
Okay.
But he's got this series called The Few, The Proud, and he's up to about 150 or 200 tapes by now. Just Marine after Sailor after Marine doing this.
And they're just jacking off?
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of guys get into that. I personally don't.
Yeah. I don't. I have a friend of mine that does, and I don't get it either. But so, okay.
Hey, whatever floats your boat.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Well, go on. I'm just curious. I was just curious. Okay. So then after that, they obviously liked you, and then they said, hey, we want you to do other films. And so you did probably what you might want to say traditional porn then, where you're actually having sex with somebody else rather than just masturbating. Is that right?
Yeah, what he did next was he had a studio at the time, East San Diego, and he just had kind of like a little, basically it was like a locker room set up back there, and it was a quick, you know, come in here at 6 o'clock and you would spend 3 hours with, you know, 3 or 4 other guys, do a variety of scenes, switching positions and all that, and, you know, he'd pay you $500.
Okay.
For 3 hours worth of work, you know, it's fine, the guys are good looking, hey, you know, who doesn't want that? And then you sign this form, which is called an absolute release, which means you give them the rights to use these videos, pictures, for whatever, whenever purpose they want. And, you know, I wasn't stupid. At the time I was signing this, I thought, I can't, you know, this is ridiculous. This is not nearly enough money for what I'm risking here. At the time, being in the military,
exactly.
On active duty, I could have gone to jail, which is what happened to some guy recently at Fort Bragg in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's gone to jail for 3 months. You know, if you're aggravated sodomy under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, you can get up to 3 years.
Wow.
Per occurrence. So, you know, by the time I did 8 videos, you're looking at it. If they wanted to be real fixed about it, it could have been 24 years or whatever at Fort Leavenworth.
Exactly. So, I mean, there's a big risk in that. And see, the other thing is that he's making probably millions of dollars off of this video that, you know, that you did, and you only got $500 out of it. So if you're going to make a risk, then at least get paid for it. And so I was just curious, when you did these videos, did you have a say at all of what you were going to do and what you were not going to do, or did they just say, okay, this is what's going to happen?
Well, obviously the producers and the directors try to get you to do as much as they possibly can, but I mean, there were guys who would only, you know, they would only top, or then there was one straight guy on one of the sets, and he showed up, and that day he was supposed to top another guy, and he just automatically started talking about he had a cold and he didn't really want to do anything, and he was being a real prima donna on the set. That day was really bad for shooting. So, you know, it's very, all these human issues come into it. So, I mean, I was willing to do anything. I didn't really care.
Okay. All right. Well, what I'd like to do is just hold that thought right now, because I'd like to, because we're at the 30-minute mark, and I'd like to take a quick break to break the show up. But I'd like to, thank you very much for the very first part here. And again, I'd like to thank the listeners for being part of the program and listening to the show. Again, you can go to the website, which is rambleredhead.blogspot.com. You can also send me an email at rambleredhead@gmail.com. And also, you can make a comment on my phone number, comment line at 574-203-4263. And again, I appreciate any feedback that you have. And again, I'd like to thank Rich for part one of the interview. Hopefully, we'll have part two up very soon. And I'd like to thank you, the listener, for being part of the program. So keep on listening to the Ramble Redhead Show.